Welcome back to the program. Today, more than ever, we seem to have lost our appreciation for science, for reality, for fact. Perhaps it's no surprise that from our earliest years we learn how to suspend disbelief, to embrace myth and fantasy, and then it's only one step away from being captured by religious hogwash. In fact, the real story of science and evolution is far and away the more exciting narrative, yet it continues to fight for its rightful place in the pantheon of ideas. Few have fought this battle more passionately than our guest today, Richard Dawkins. He is the former Charles Simony Professor of Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. He is one of our prized public intellectuals, the best-selling author of The Selfish Gene, The Blind Watchmaker, and Climbing Mount Improbable. He is one of the principal progenitors of a new atheism and a search for respect for science. It is my pleasure to welcome Richard Dawkins back to this program to talk about his newest work, The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. Richard Dawkins, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Delight to have you here. For so long, we had, in the world and in this country, we had a respect for science. We loved science. We appreciated science. We seem to have lost that thread. What happened, in your view?
I'm not really sure. I mean, part of it, I think, is that the offspin of science in technology has produced some horrific things like weapons of mass destruction. That, of course, is nothing to do with, well, it's to do with science, but it is technology rather than science. But I think also that what rather moves me is that science is wonderful, and people may have lost sight of that. Science really fills the gap that religion leaves, because science enables you to look at the world, to look at the universe, and marvel at it, and marvel at the, what a privilege it is to be present in it, and that the process that has brought us here.
And yet it is so difficult today to get people to understand that. I mean, the statistic is something like 40% of Americans, you know, believe the creation myth.
Well, it's even worse than that. They believe that the universe is less than 10,000 years old, which is wrong by many, many, many orders of magnitude. And that, I think, it's not just wrong, it's tragically wrong, because you're missing so much by not appreciating the world in which you stand.
And as you point out in The Magic of Reality, the magic of reality itself, the magic of science, the narrative of what really evolved is far more spectacular than any of this mythology.
It's far more spectacular. It's far more magical in the best sense of the word, not in the supernatural sense, because we're not, I mean, there's no such thing as supernatural magic. Nor is it, obviously one has to mention magic in the sort of stage conjuring sense, but there's a third sense of magic, which is the exhilarating magic that you get when you contemplate the world and the universe.
The magic that comes from looking out at the stars or looking through a microscope or kids even when they're young just looking at bugs and things in nature.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to capture in this book, The Magic of Reality.
It's interesting that kids are born with a kind of natural curiosity, particularly about the natural world. And there's something we do in the process of education, even sometimes in the process of education about science, that squashes that.
Well, I think there is. And I think maybe one of the things it is that we teach children what is the case or what is believed to be the case traditionally in their society. So a child is taught, you are a Christian child, or you are a Muslim child, you are a Jewish child, and you're taught what the traditional beliefs of your people are, instead of being taught to use your curiosity, ask for evidence, find out what really is going on, and question everything.
How much of it comes from a kind of myopia that's at play, the idea that we tend not to see the whole world or the whole universe, that we only see it from a really small point of view?
Well, that's historically always been the case, of course, and for many centuries people didn't even realize the world was round, and then they did realize it was round but thought it was the center of things, and then people didn't realize that the galaxy that we're in even is only one of billions of galaxies. So we're constantly being moved away from our egotistical centrism.
There's also this sense of a fact-based science. I mean, many of these things are simply settled issues, that there is a body of evidence, a fact of mathematics, whether it's in physics or biology, that in fact we seem to want to deny in some respects.
Yes. I mean, science is taught very often as a set of facts that you need in order to pass the exam. rather than being taught as a method for finding out and a constantly open-ended method. And science, of course, is changing as new evidence comes in. That's one of the glories of science.
Have scientists over the years, those that teach it, have they had an important enough sense of the power of narrative to tell the real story of science, the way you outline it in The Magic of Reality?
I think some scientists are too preoccupied with getting on with their research rather than with telling the story to people at large. And I do think it's a really part of the duty of a scientist to communicate what it is that they're doing.
I mean, one of the things is that there is an inherent poetry in science.
Very much so. I wrote a whole book about that called Unweaving the Rainbow about a decade ago. I think there's enormous poetry in science. I've actually even thought that it's about time a scientist won the Nobel Prize for Literature, not just the Nobel Prize for whatever science it is.
Is it the sort of Judeo-Christian mythology is so strong, or it's that the competing narrative hasn't done a good enough job?
Well, I don't think it's that strong. I mean, I think it's true that any narrative which is passed on from parent to child when the child is at a sufficiently impressionable age is likely to stick around. What I've done in The Magic of Reality is each chapter, which is a question about the real universe or the real world, each chapter begins with myths. So, for example, the chapter on what is the sun begins with an Aztec myth on what is the sun, and various other myths, ancient Egyptian, ancient Greek myths, and so on, and then moves on to what really is the sun, which is the scientific answer, of course. So each chapter begins with myths and then goes on to the science. And among the myths, I have tossed in the Judeo-Christian myth, really to show that it's just one myth among hundreds. There are hundreds, thousands of myths all around the world, which many of them are very colorful, and the Judeo-Christian myths are colorful too. But there's nothing special about the Judeo-Christian myths. They are just myths like any other, and I treat them as myths like any other in my book.
But of course, they've garnered so much power over the years.
By sort of historical accident,
right.
Really. I mean, the accident of the fact that the Emperor Constantine of the Roman Empire decreed that Christianity was to be the official religion of the Roman Empire. And as a result, the full power of Rome at that time was deployed to spread Christianity around Europe, and it's now spread around the world.
How much of the power that grows up around these myths comes from, as I mentioned in the introduction, this kind of suspension of disbelief, the fairy tales that children hear?
Well, I think you've got to suspend your disbelief in order for a myth to spread. But as for which myth spread, that's pretty much historical accident, I think. There's nothing special about the Judeo-Christian myth. It could have been, you know, we could still be living with the Roman myths of Jupiter and Mars and Venus, or we could be living with the Norse myths of Thor and Odin.
But of course, we have science to set us on the right path.
Yes, and that would have set us on the right path whether we were brought up with Norse myths or Greek myths or Roman myths. Science is unique in that it's based on evidence, whereas none of the myths are.
Talk a little bit about what you see happening with children, particularly the children of that 40% or more that we were talking about earlier, that simply get it wrong and that then perpetuate that misinformation.
Yeah, it perpetuates from generation to generation, because children of an impressionable age tend to believe what they're told, and so they tell their children who tell their children. I think it's even worse in the Islamic world, where schooling in many parts of the Islamic world is nothing but the Quran. They learn virtually nothing else but the Quran. And then we shouldn't be surprised when they grow up, a minority of them turn into suicide bombers.
We also have this debate about what should go in and not in science textbooks, as if the facts are something that are malleable or
yes.
Debatable.
Sometimes people say, well, it's your opinion and you're entitled to your opinion. I'm entitled to my opinion. No, you're not. Opinions don't count when we've got facts to deal with. Facts are facts. Evidence is evidence, and that's what demonstrates what is true. And you can't hold an opinion that goes against the facts. It's not logical.
How is this different, as you've seen it develop, how is it different between the world of biology and evolutionary biology specifically and the world of physics?
Well, they're very different. I mean, physics underlies biology. Biology can never violate the laws of physics, but biology has been produced by this very remarkable process called evolution by natural selection, which, while never violating the laws of physics, does produce very, very curious results. Figures show that distinguished scientists are mostly atheist, but there's a slight tendency for physical scientists to be slightly more religious than biological scientists. It's only a very slight tendency.
And why do you think even that tendency is?
I don't know. I mean, the figure's not. I mean, they're only about 10% of the elite scientists of the National Academy in America or the Royal Society in the British Commonwealth. Only about 10% are religious, but it's just slightly more physical scientists than biological scientists. I don't know why that is. It may be because if you don't understand evolution, the sheer beauty and complexity and organization of living things wows you into thinking that there must be some sort of designer. And biologists understand that that's not so, because they fully comprehend evolution. And physical scientists, whose minds are dealing with other things, don't perhaps fully grasp that sometimes.
There also is something, particularly in the realm of astrophysics, perhaps, of kind of looking out into the cosmos that creates some of that mythology as well, I suppose.
Well, certainly looking out into the cosmos creates a sense of awe, but that should not, in a good scientist, lead to any kind of supernatural feeling. It should simply lead to a feeling of challenge to do your science, to understand it.
Talk about that, because it is one of the kinds of magic that you discuss in The Magic of Reality, the kind of supernatural magic that is one of the misconceptions.
Yes, I mean, I think there's something incoherent about supernaturalism. Whenever you come across something you don't understand, and there are plenty of things we don't yet understand, in biology we don't yet understand consciousness, in physics they don't yet understand where the laws of physics originally come from. But when there's something you don't understand, you don't lie down under it and say, oh, I don't understand it, so it must be supernatural. It must be some supernatural being did it. You try to develop your science further so that you do understand. You go to work on it, you work harder, you do more experiments, you do more observations. Maybe you actually change some fundamental theories of your physics, of your science. But you don't just lie down in that cowardly, giving up sort of way and say, oh, I don't understand, it must be supernatural. That's no way to proceed.
Does that come from a kind of intellectual laziness?
Yes, I think laziness is a very good word. I use the word cowardice. I think laziness is also another good word we could use.
And certainly we see more and more of that today.
Not among scientists, I think.
No.
But yes, you could be right. Actually, that figure of 40% of people who believe that the world is less than 10,000 years old, that figure has remained pretty stable ever since the 1980s. It's a remarkably stable figure.
And those are the same people that just keep breeding and replacing themselves,
exactly.
I suppose.
Yes, exactly.
Talk a little bit about this volume, The Magic of Reality, and the illustrations that are also a beautiful part of this, the work that Dave McKean has done.
Yes, the illustrator is Dave McKean, who is a well-known illustrator of books for young people, and I think they complement the text very well. There are 12 chapters. Most of them begin with a question. The first chapter is, what is magic, what is reality? And then we go on to, who was the first person? Then, why are there so many different kinds of animals? I forget the order after that. Maybe, why do we have night and day, winter and summer? What is the sun? What is a rainbow? How did everything begin? What is an earthquake? Why do bad things happen? Which is a rather strange title, because it's really just a matter of why do things happen, and some of those things are bad. But there are people who sort of feel there ought to be a kind of natural justice such that, I don't know, bad things only happen to people who deserve it or something, whereas, of course, bad things just happen. Are we alone? That's another one, which is a sort of very speculative chapter about whether life on this planet is unique, or whether it's to be found elsewhere. And finally, what is a miracle, which comes back to the idea of supernatural magic and deals with those examples of alleged supernatural magic that people believe in, whereas the supernatural magic that people don't believe in are things like Cinderella's fairy godmother turning a pumpkin into a into a coach.
I'm sure there are some that argue for that as well. Talk a little bit about whether or not it is a zero-sum game, that in fact, if one is a passionate believer in science and fact, whether there is any room for any supernatural views.
Well, many people would say that there is room, because there are many people who are both scientists and religious. I find that hard to take, I must say. I find it hard to reconcile a supernaturalism with a true spirit of science. So my feeling is that it ought to be a zero-sum game, but it has to be admitted that there are many scientists who do manage to be religious.
And how do they square that circle?
Well, there are some whose religion is a very sort of vague deism, a vague feeling that there's some kind of great spirit in the universe, perhaps who started things off and then took no further part. It's easier for them to square the circle than for those who are of a more evangelical bent, who actually, well, in a few extreme cases, take the book of Genesis literally, and that really is hard to understand. There are some who say that the Bible should be taken as metaphor rather than as literal fact, and that's obviously a lot easier to reconcile with science. But I find it genuinely hard to see how any true scientist, true working scientist, can at the same time believe in something supernatural. What you can believe in is something that we don't yet understand. It's simply a challenge to work harder.
And that really is part of the core of this, that those things that we don't understand call out for more science and more investigation, as you indicated before, not to give up and just say it's some other power
exactly.
or some other force.
Exactly, yes.
Talk a little bit about some of the things that you touch on in the book. For example, the sun you mentioned before, earthquakes, that there are clear-cut scientific explanations for
these
things.
Yes, and there are things that we now understand that used not to be understood, and so there was a time when things seemed supernatural, and then now we understand them. The sun used to be worshipped as a god. Earthquakes were regarded as punishment from the gods, and in some places they still are. And as science advances, it steadily eats away at these mysteries.
When you look at children today, talk about what you see in terms of their curiosity and what the potential is to really make them understand these facts, the excitement of science.
Children are proverbially curious and always asking why. I sometimes wonder whether they really want to know the answer or whether it's a kind of habit. But I'm sure many of them do, and I've, in a sense, field-tested some of these chapters of The Magic of Reality on young children, and it's very nice to see their eyes light up with understanding.
Part of it is, as indicated earlier, that these are great stories in and of themselves. I mean, the story about how from 4 billion years we went from nothing to who we are today is a pretty remarkable story.
It's an utterly remarkable story, and it's such a privilege that thanks to Darwin and his successors, we really do understand it.
And that we can explain it, and that the evidence is there to support it.
The evidence is there to support it, and it's not actually that difficult to understand.
And yet we have people that would be, you know, leaders of the free world that don't seem to quite grasp it.
No, that's correct. It's really shocking to me that anybody could be even contemplated as a president of the United States who takes a creation myth, one of thousands of creation myths, takes it literally. It is an astonishing thing. I mean, you think that people who can tie their shoelaces would have more sense than to believe that.
The other part of it is, that goes along with the science, I suppose, is the importance of mathematics as a tool in all of this.
Yes. Mathematics is the deductive tool that enables you to go from hypotheses to see what predictions can be derived from assumptions, and then you can test the predictions. Modern physics is almost entirely mathematics, and you have to be mathematical in order to appreciate physics. To quite a big extent, that's also true of modern biology. It's not entirely true. You can still be a good biologist without being very mathematical. It's getting harder.
It's interesting, too, because a lot of people that question all of this, that criticize what we're talking about, that don't have that respect for science, they don't quite see that nexus with the math. And they might not argue with the math, but they'll argue with the scientific conclusions. And it makes no sense.
Well, that's right, yes. That's absolutely right.
Do you see a point somewhere down the road where this begins to turn around, that science starts to win out again?
Yes, I think in the long run that's got to be true, but it's a slow road, and we've got a lot of work to do. In the Islamic world, one almost despairs, but in Western Europe, reason and religion reason is increasing and religion is decreasing. And I think the same will be true in North America as well in the long run, that we've got a temporary blip in the wrong direction.
Richard Dawkins, his new book is The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. Richard, as always, it's a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.